Welcome, welcome, welcome.
I'll do a quick restart, not the whole thing. My name is Tal Ha. I'm in the... Y'all want to hear the song again? Maybe we'll play it at the end for the folks that are just coming in. We played some a song earlier and to kind of get us in the emotional state for this talk. And again, my name is Tal Ha. I'm in the sociology department. And you're here to share in this discussion about the war on drugs and its connection to mass incarceration of black men in our society, okay? I was just going over the idea that our lives are not individualized. Our lives are politicized, and they are contextualized in history. So there are a couple of what I call fallacies or wrong thinking about people's conditions. And one is that over time, things will just get better. You know, that, it's been 100 years since X, Y, Z, and so things should have gotten better by now. And yet, that is not true, and so we have to look at history. We also have to look at the economics that play a role. I mean, how much does money play into this discussion? So we have to have that conversation. Our lives are political in which is the idea that our politicians use issues to kind of hype things up, to sensationalize them, to feed into rhetoric. And rhetoric is the idea of shaping the language to be persuasive. You know, rhetoric is like, how am I going to get you to believe what I'm saying here? And so using issues in a political way to frame rhetoric and convince us that what we're trying to do is the right thing, okay? And racial is part attitude, okay, and prejudice, but is also, we should see it as outcomes. That when we look at the outcomes of our policies, that it's telling us a story. That when we look at the outcomes of history and the events in time, they tell us a story about today. So when we, you know, put all these pieces together in our recipe, that is the only way we can, see something in a more holistic way. So I'm going to try to, you know, touch upon each of these in about an hour. Okay? Many of us are familiar with this idea, this truth, this social fact, that the United States is the number one incarcerator of its citizens. In the United States, we have over 2 million of our citizens in the incarceral system. Hi, Marcus. If we added up all of the people in prison in the world, right, our prisoners make up the largest percentage of that. Right? We are 5% of the world population, but we house 25% of prisoners around the world. Okay? That's a lot of people. When we factor out this issue of race, it is very clear to see the outcomes, the story that our data is telling us about who those folks are. Okay? Those folks are black men. So in the United States, incarceration by race and ethnicity in 2010, you can see here the large proportion of black men in prison versus Latino versus white. We also now take it a little bit close to home and look at California, and we see that proportion even, you know, more stagnant in the data. And notice here, this is a group that no one ever talks about. American Indian and the Native American population as a high proportion of our incarcerated folks. The youth, the young, right? Who are we incarcerating? Young black men in our society. These individuals have families, They have children that are separated from them. In fact, incarceration has become such a prominent issue that they made a Sesame Street episode about incarceration. Right? A little puppet who's like all sad because he's like, oh, I should show it to us. I thought about it this morning, but let me show you a clip. It's Sesame Street. Incarceration episode. There's a song to it too.
Oh my goodness.
No, it's very Sesame Street-ish.
Incarceration.
My dad's in jail.
Why?
I don't like to talk about it. Most people don't understand.
Actually, I do understand what you're going through. When I was about your age, my dad was incarcerated too.
What? He was?
Wait, what's incarcerated? And why was your dad in it?
Incarcerated is when someone breaks the law, a grown-up rule, and then they have to go to jail or prison.
And your dad was incarcerated?
Yes, he was in prison. So I know how hard it can be, Alex.
Yeah, it is hard.
You're not alone. I've been there too. Many children have. Many are.
Need I say more? So our young black men are of a particular interest group in this conversation, and that incarceration affecting not just those individuals, but their entire families and the communities to which they belong. So here's an interesting thing. I've heard people, the rhetoric say, well, it's just crime out there, and so we're just putting people in prison because we're trying to fight crime. And if we look at crime trends over time in the United States, we have seen a dip in crime, overall crime, for all acts of crime decrease since the 1990s. And yet, our incarceration rates have gone up. We have built more prisons and jails and have incarcerated more of our citizens within that same time frame. All right, so what's the explanation here? Anybody want to take a guess?
Inequality.
Sentencing. Inequality, sentencing.
The industry became,
private? Okay, yeah, the industry, that's true. The industry did become private in the 70s and 80s. Yes? Yes, sir?
Longer prison sentences.
Longer prison sentences for what crimes?
Drugs.
The difference between
for drugs. All right, so now we're making that connection. This is about drug crimes, okay? Incarcerated Americans and the notion of history, politics coming together. In 1971, President Richard Nixon declared the official war on drugs. And since then, lots and lots of policies have been created to really snatch that area of crime. And so you can see the line increasing here. In the 80s, somebody said something about sentencing. Absolutely. 1984, the Sentencing Reform Act. Happening here, and then we see that large spike. And as Dr. Wojcik pointed out, the privatization of prisons, meaning the opportunity for prisons to be corporations and making money, happened around this time as well. So we see a conflating of all of these different things coming together. Where's the race on this? Where does race fit in all this? So I'm going to take us to a little diversion and some history. And I want to talk about the Haldeman Diaries. He was Nixon's chief of staff, and he, in these diaries, published a lot of the conversations that he had with Nixon at the time. And so you might have heard in the rhetoric that Nixon was a racist. And so what does that mean to say that, to accuse Nixon of being a racist? Well, here's some excerpts of these comments that Nixon had made, according to Haldeman himself. P, referring to President Nixon, emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. Pointed out that there has never in history been an adequate black nation. And they are the only race of which this is true. He says Africa is useless. Very strong racial statements here. I give you another example. Words from Nixon himself. In 2010, the White House released tapes of conversations that Nixon had with various folks in his proximity. This one happened to be with his secretary, Rose, and he was speaking about Bill Rogers, his Secretary of State. He says, Nixon says, Bill Rogers has got somewhat, and to his credit, it's a decent feeling, but somewhat sort of a sort of blind spot on the black thing, because he's been in New York. And what he was referring to is Bill Rogers saying, well, you know, black folks have come a long way. They've gotten, you know, jobs, and they're making their communities better, and there are even some smart ones. Okay, that's what Bill said. Nixon then says, my own view is, I think he's right if you're talking in terms of 500 years. I think it's wrong if you're talking in terms of 50 years. What has to happen is that they have to be, frankly, inbred. And you just, that's the only thing that's going to do it, Rose. So the idea that black as pure, as a pure folk, can't better themselves, that somehow they'll have to be inbred with white folks to advance in society. This is the perspective of Mr. Nixon himself. So when folks have made that connection between the war on drugs and a president with this perspective, one can't get the sense that there are some racial intentions driving these policies and practices, okay? But it's not so crystal clear. There's, you know, like I said, it's complicated, it's messy. So here we gotta go back to a little bit of history and this notion of the Southern Strategy. How many of you have heard of the Southern Strategy? One person? Me? What do you know about it?
Well, basically it was, if I remember correctly from your class, it was to keep African Americans as a secondary class in the United States. I might be thinking of something else.
Okay, all right. The Southern Strategy in this context, some people are like, oh, in the Civil War, it was the way the South decided to fight. Yes, that's true. But in this context, the Southern Strategy refers to a political plan after Reconstruction, right? After blacks gained the rights to do this and this and that, this idea that, you know, how are we going to get more voters for the Republican Party? So the Southern Strategy comes out of the Republican Party, and they're devising ways of how to get votes. And so the idea was, if we can go appeal to the poor white folks, right, that somehow they should separate themselves from the black folks, we can garner those votes. So then it became this practice of getting votes. How do we get people to vote a certain way, to vote a certain political party, but also to vote certain items, certain things, certain policies, right? So that's the context of the Southern Strategy. How was it implemented over time? Well, what we see is in the South, it was really, really popular in terms of incarceration. Because when you look at the differences by region, you're seeing here in this chart that in the South is where we have always seen the highest rates of imprisonment. And over time, with the growth, the South is the area with the highest rates of death penalty and drug incarceration and all forms of incarceration, period. Okay? Now, talk about Jim Crow, because that's the title here, and that's kind of the overall argument that, that Alexander in her book makes, and that a lot of the criticisms of the war on drugs is claiming. What is Jim Crow? Yes, ma'am.
The laws that were put in place to keep African Americans from voting and actually utilizing education.
Oh, everything. Everything, yeah. It's separate but equal. White water fountain, black water fountain. White restaurant, black restaurant. White part of the bus, black part of the bus, right? White schools, black schools. Okay, you're not slaves anymore. We're not gonna, you know, use you in that way, but we still want to separate you, segregate you. So by law, de jure, meaning by law, right? That was the law, and then it was dismantled. And so we had different policies to do that. For example, we passed Brown the Supreme Court case of Brown versus Board of Education, right? Tried to integrate schools. We had the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We had the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We had the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And we created these policies with the hope that it would force us to change our attitudes and our belief systems and our perspectives about black folks in our society. Yeah? Yeah? Okay, so then there's this hope that now time is gonna help, time is going to change our attitudes and our values. Okay, that past attitudes and values would shift into present values and attitudes that would no longer carry this idea that blacks are separate from whites. But now we have de facto. De facto is what is in practice. Here's what we see in practice. Drug criminalization and its outcomes, right, which are very racialized. School to prison pipeline. That could be a whole other lecture about how schools have become these places where we criminalize bad behavior, right? How many of y'all got in a little scuffle in middle school, high school, maybe broke some rules here and there, right? Did you ever get arrested for that? He did. He's like, I did. Yes, I did. And so if you're a little bit older in the audience, you might be familiar with the idea that a brawl fight would get you detention, right?
Yes.
And you go to the guidance center and you write out the rules in the book and then, you know, you talk to your parents. And, how do I know this? Because that was me. Right? That was me in guidance, like, I will not fight. I will not fight. I will not fight. And then the call to my parents, I'm like, why are you fighting? Well, she called me a chink and I was mad. You know, so, but today, even minor infractions get students arrested. Who was the kid that got arrested for making a clock?
Science project.
Right? The science project. But they thought it was a
bomb.
And why did they think it was a bomb? Because he looked like a certain person, a certain type of person, right? So the school-to-prison pipeline is this idea that we have racialized outcomes in schools by these certain types of infractions. How many of us are familiar with the video of the school resource officer, that's what we call him, who body slammed the young woman, right, in her seat, right? So this, that is de facto, and the data, the statistics, the outcome of those social facts is that black students are much, much more likely to be criminalized in schools than other groups. So we have a school-to-prison pipeline that has been racialized. Environmental practices. What's going on right now in Michigan?
Water.
The water. In Flint, Michigan. Water is brown, my friends, right? But we see the environmental practices that have impacted these communities. That is de facto. Redlining, this notion in mortgage practices and real estate practices that keep our living situations segregated. So I can't, I'm not going to go into detail about how all this happened, because then we'll be talking here for 5 hours and it'll get dark. But these are examples of de facto, right? These are the practices, even though we say we have these laws, we say we have these policies. So to say that policy will change things, that's a little misleading, because we've figured out different systems and different ways to do things that still have the same results. I like this quote in Alexander's book, because we're going to take this as the jumping point. The war on drugs was part of a grand Republican Party strategy, known as the Southern Strategy, of using racially coded get-tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare to appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who were resentful of, anxious about, and threatened by many gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. It's a bold statement. That is a strong statement to make. So what do we know about the Southern Strategy that she's referring to? I want to introduce you to some words by Lee Atwater. Lee Atwater was the political strategist. He was the guy who would help the Republican Party think about how we're going to frame our communication, right? So this excerpt that I've got typed up for you, we're going to listen to the actual audio. It was not released until way after his death, because when he was recorded saying it, he actually told the journalist, you're not going to quote me on this, right? So as a journalist, they really couldn't quote him on it. And so it kind of stayed hidden for a long, long time. And people had all these conspiracy theories about how the Republican Party, you know, would, like, change the language of things and change the rhetoric so that, you know, they could get people to vote the way they wanted. And so here's kind of this evidence that was sitting silently until he died. And when he passed away, his wife was listening to the tapes, and she felt that this was so important, it should be known to the public. And so that is how we have record of Lee Atwater's Southern Strategy. So I'm going to play it for you. I've got the words for you.
Here's how I would approach that issue as a statistician or a political scientist, or no, as a psychologist, which I'm not. Is how abstract you handle the race thing. In other words, you start out, and now y'all don't quote me. You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts your backfire. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you get so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and a byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than white. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than even the busing thing. And a hell of a lot more abstract than they were there. So any way you look at it, race is coming on the back burner.
Alright, how did that make you feel? To listen to those words. And to know that political strategists are thinking about ways to impact that rhetoric, to impact the discussions, to impact the opinions and the attitudes and the values of we people in terms of policies and practices. Okay. So here we've got this individual who's like, I know for most of us who are sociologists and kind of we'll label ourselves as liberal, Democrat, you know. We look at this and go, oh my gosh, it's the Republican Party, and this is what's wrong with them, they're racist, and this and that. But, in the context of his whole interview, right, if you listen to the whole interview, what he was really trying to do is say, you know what, we want to move away from the race thing, because things are really about class. Things are really about economics. So in another excerpt, this tickles me, because as a sociologist, I would never think that a person like Lee Atwater would be reading Karl Marx, right, and saying that the voter, in my judgment, will be more likely to vote his economic interests than he will anything else. And that is the voter that I think a fairly slow but very steady process will go Republican. Right? That's why we keep hearing from that party about economics and class. In my judgment, Karl Marx is right. Right? The real issues will ultimately be the economic issues. And so if we can code language in ways that appeals to people without talking about race, right? We create it in other forms and formats and discussions, then people will kind of think about their own interests and vote on those rather than saying, oh, this is a racist thing. So now we've got this conflating of race and class. And so I think also psychologically it makes us feel better to say, well, it's a class thing and I care about poor people and we should help poor people. Because then if we say, well, I care about black people, and we should help black people, and then people are like, oh, well, that's reverse racism when you try to help black people, and it gets into this kind of long, drawn-out conversation that becomes too politically correct or incorrect to talk about, but it's never politically incorrect to talk about class, right? So in many ways, Mr. Atwater was brilliant, right? Brilliant. So here we have all these pieces coming together to thinking about the war on drugs and how it became this thing. Remember that earlier slide about crime increasing in the 80s and 90s. And so you have a public that is fearful and seeing, oh my gosh, crime is a problem in our society. The data is telling us that we have these crime waves, all right? And then so our politicians politicizing that issue and saying, well, we need to be tough on crime. We have to pass policies that are tough on crime. There would never be a politician who would run for office and say, I want to be soft on crime. Right? So everyone's pitching the tough on crime model, and therefore bleeding to the tough on drugs, because drugs are now related to crime. Drugs are criminal. Drugs are an individual decision, poor decision making, a pathological problem. There are alternatives. We'll talk about those later. So here, the data showing us the incarceration rates, Sentencing Reform Act, Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, 24 states adopting and strengthening three strikes legislation about right here, and we see the spike, okay? So these are some more examples of policies that came about from that rhetoric that we have to be tough on crime, that we have to be tough on drugs, and that the only way to be tough on them is to incarcerate them. California, here we are. We were not immune to the trends. We saw a decrease in crime in California, and yet our prison population had increased over the last two decades. How much money are we talking about here? In 1971, $100 million was the budget for the war on drugs. In 2011, the Obama administration proposed $15.6 billion for the war on drugs. This is only the federal level. That doesn't even include states' money that they're spending for the war on drugs. $3.5 billion alone on marijuana at the federal level. $3.5 billion. talking about a lot of dollars. And the increase in spending year after year after year after year. Maybe one blip in 2008 where we saw a slight decrease, and then boom, right, an additional $2 billion. Experts say, and who's an expert here? I like this video because two reasons. One, it's a little bit old and outdated, like 10, 15 years old, but everything I see in there and hear people saying is like, it's so timely that we're talking on Groundhog Day, like, you know, like, oh, it's happening over, and then it's wake up and it's happening. And so I watched this video from like, you know, decades ago, and then like, I'm like, it's still the same. So feel me on that when we take a look at this.
Have you used illegal drugs? The government says a third of you have, but about 5% if you use them regularly. It's probably more, because how many people answer honestly when the government asks? So what do we do about this? America's approach has been to go to war.
Mustad, it's showtime!
Police departments fight the war every day.
Put your hands up!
When we fight against drugs, we fight for the souls of our fellow Americans.
Get down!
There's pressure on police to do more.
Pressure from the politicians or pressure from the community to do something about it.
Jerry Oliver is Detroit's police chief.
It puts policing in a position of being involved in tactics that are desperate.
What does he mean by desperate?
Since the transactions are normally between a willing buyer and a willing seller, it causes the police to snoop.
Out-of-state tag, 9-5.
To sneak, to stoop, and to snare individuals, sometimes in ways in which, even though I'm in the business, and I know that it is legal, it's questionable.
It's clear down there, you can send those decoys in.
He may say it's questionable, but on this day, his officers are out on the street pretending to be dealers. Dozens of people drive up and ask to buy drugs. Then the cops radio ahead.
14, she's out now. You can come make your move.
They tell uniformed officers, arrest the customer.
What's the problem?
You know what you did then, right?
Nothing. I was attempting to buy some drugs from there.
That's all you had to say, ma'am.
50 police officers were involved in this sting, though most of those arrested were trying to buy less than $25 worth of pot.
Okay.
Even when they make a big seizure. The head of narcotics isn't convinced that they're making progress.
Last year we had probably our largest cocaine seizure in history.
However, it hasn't seemed to have an impact on drying up the amount of drugs that are actually coming into the city.
Hasn't had an impact. That's the story all over America. In the past 10 years, arrests have gone up nearly 50%. But the number of users and the supply of drugs has stayed about the same.
There you go.
Got it.
Are we making progress? Absolutely.
Asa Hutchinson, President Bush's choice to run the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, travels the world telling people we're winning the drug war.
Overall drug use in the United States has been reduced by 50% over the last 20 years.
But was that because of government's policies? Or was it just people wising up after the binges of the 70s?
Drug use is down. It's not down lately. Last 10 years, it hasn't dropped.
But we have flatlined. I believe we lost our focus to a certain extent.
It's hard to see how we lost focus, because you're spending more.
I don't believe that we've had the same type of energy devoted to it as we have in certain times in the past.
It's not clear how you measure energy, but federal spending on the drug war has kept going up. It's up 50% over the past 10 years, and President Bush wants still more.
To reduce illegal drug use in America.
And that's just the Washington money. Cities and states spend still more.
up to 3/4 of our budget somehow can be traced back to fighting this war on drugs.
3/4 of the budget, if the drugs are as available as ever.
Didn't I just ask you if you had some heroin on you?
That was, I didn't even have that in my pocket.
The U.S. failed to stop the sellers. A newer tactic is to have authorities go after buyers. Here in Detroit, they're confiscating cars.
This vehicle now belongs to the city of Detroit's narcotic bureau.
This officer's car, now chasing down a drug buyer, was confiscated on a previous raid. They've taken so many cars, the police lot looks like a dealership.
Can I take my charcoal or no?
It costs people $900 to get their car back.
We're taking cars, we're taking property, we're taking houses.
Taking them and selling them. They bust up the furniture just to get rid of it. They don't even save the TV sets. Too much trouble, say the police. We just want to clear out the house and sell.
Wonderful. They should take it.
Most of the neighbors are thrilled.
Good. Take the house. Take the one next to it. Take the furniture and take the owners to court.
But when government confiscates houses or cars and sells them, it keeps the money. The drug war gives officials an incentive to take more. Is this what we want? All the seizures? All the arrests?
We will never arrest our way out of this problem. All you have to do is go to almost any corner in any city, it will tell you that.
Oliver was once a big believer in the drug war. Not anymore.
If we did not have this drug war going on, we could spend more time going after robbers and rapists and burglars and murderers. That's what we really should be geared up to do. Clearly, we're losing the war on drugs in this country.
You told me you was gonna stop selling dope. Remember that?
It's insanity to keep doing the same thing over and over again.
Insanity? It's an odd statement from a police chief, but we hear the same frustration from others. In 1998, we visited this neighborhood in the Bronx, a neighborhood struggling with drugs and crime. 4 years and 15,000 narcotics arrests later, the drug dealers are still everywhere. The kids know where they are.
Every single blind.
And the violence is constant. Every week they hear gunshots.
I fear for my child. I mean, every morning she walks to school. What am I supposed to do? Buy her bulletproof vest? I mean, this is really serious.
Gunshots going off, 9:30, 10:30, 11:30. I'm scared.
The government says we're winning the war on drugs.
Well, not on Briggs Avenue and 196th Street.
Overall crime is down in America and in the South Bronx, too. But drug use, the drug supply, plentiful.
Here we are now, making one more connection to mass incarceration and the economics, right? In the video, you heard some economic incentive. What was that again? What was the incentive here?
Voting.
Taking property.
Cars.
Is it 3/4 of their budget come from drugs?
3/4 of the budget going to drug enforcement? And so there's this language of incentivization, right? And we can even couple that with laws such as the forfeiture laws as a policy that allows law enforcement agencies to do such things. But the other institution of incentive is the private prison. The prison that is allowed to make money as a corporation. And so we gotta dive into that aspect to complete this picture. So the prison industrial complex is this notion that prisons, while run by government, are now part of business. And so this complex relationship says that there's probably a conflict of interest, because if you have businesses influencing government policy, they're going to affect policies that will then benefit themselves. Okay? This term was coined after the military industrial complex, which Roosevelt many, many years ago warned us, or was it Eisenhower?
Eisenhower,
sorry. That we are going to war for money, right? That we decided that decisions about going to war were no longer about war itself, but that there were economic incentives. So now imprisoning folks in our society is no longer about deterrence or no longer about rehabilitation or even, you know, paying your dues. It really is now driven by an economic incentive. But let's not just blame the prisons themselves. There are other entities that benefit from prisons and the individuals in prison. This is a drawing from an artist in prison about slave labor and connecting that to the old notion of plantation and into the factories and now being part of a new slave labor force. That's the new Jim Crow, the new form, right, of slavery. I want to digress just a second to announce to you that if you have an opportunity, starting March 16th through April 14th, MiraCosta's art department is bringing the Prison in Arts project to our campus. We will see on display at the Kruglak Gallery works of art done by folks in prison, Donovan State Prison, at the southernmost part of our county, all right? And Arts in Prison is a project that came out of the idea that art was rehabilitative for our prisoners. So we are making good strides in trying to help those who are in prison, but there are still issues that run abound, okay? So March 16th, right before spring break, through April 14th, we will have those pieces at the Kruglak Gallery. On March 16th at 6:30 p.m., we will have a talk and a panel by those involved in the arts program and some people who were formerly incarcerated coming to talk about their experiences with arts in prison. Okay, I encourage you to go to that. All right, who's benefiting from this slave labor? Any companies that you know of?
Corporations, Texas Tech.
Texas Tech, how does Texas Tech benefit?
They make, all our calculators that we use are made by slave labor, prison labor.
Okay, contracts with them to make such items. Here's a policy aspect. The Work Opportunity Tax Credit is a federal tax credit providing incentives to employers for hiring groups facing high rates of unemployment, such as veterans, youths, and others. This policy or this tax credit helps these targeted groups obtain employment so they are able to gain the skills and experience necessary to obtain better future opportunities. This is based on the number of hours an employee works and benefits the employer directly. So here's a tax credit, and as you read it, would you like to put a thumbs up for this? Sure, why not? Sounds good. Until we know that under this tax credit, employers receive a tax credit of $2,400 for every work-release inmate they employ as a reward for hiring risky target groups. Here's where semantics, rhetoric, and recoding, right? How do we code language? So now, corporations using imprisoned folks for work actually get a tax credit. Is that not an incentive? Not to mention how cheaply those individuals work for. So here are some companies that have got their fingers in the cookie jar. Wendy's, Walmart, Whole Foods, Victoria's Secret, JCPenney, Starbucks, our beloved Starbucks, Avis Rent-A-Car, American Airlines. You're like, did they build the cars? Did they No, they are the call centers. They're actually using prison labor for you to make reservations on the phone.
What?
Yes. Through technology, Verizon and Sprint have implemented infrastructure into the prison so workers in prison can do these jobs. General Electric benefits because they provide all the electricity for all of the buildings. Dial soap. don't drop the soap, right? That's dialed. They're like, yeah, well, whatever, soap, drop it or not, we're making money. Microsoft, all the internet access that prisoners are allowed and the computer systems that manage the gates and all of the security and wireless and that there. And here, Fidelity. If you have any investments in Fidelity, they invest in private corporations in the prison industry. And my goodness, my surprise when I discovered that my own pension, so if there are any faculty in this room who are contributing to CalSTRS, our pension portfolio includes Corrections Corporation of America. I don't know how I feel about that right now. But knowing that that is money being invested into this thing that is so harmful to our society, so expensive for our society, and most of it for nonviolent drug offenses that have been captured within our most marginalized groups of society. Last piece here. Let's talk about this organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council. How many of you have heard of the American Legislative Exchange Council? Okay, so not many of us. If you go look them up, Wikipedia them, they will tell you that they are a nonprofit organization that puts on conferences, educational conferences, that brings together politicians and business people so they can talk about each other's interests and learn from each other. But what's really sketchy is they don't allow anybody else in these meetings. Right? If you want to go to any of these conferences, you've got to be a member. And members pay to be part of ALEC. What NPR did was they were curious about what's going on in these conferences. So they signed up one of their journalists, and they entered one of these conferences, and what they found were all these little meetings between different corporations and the politicians that they wanted to get friendly with. Does this sound like lobbying? Yes. But they'll tell you it's not lobbying. It's not lobbying. We're just hanging out, man. We're not dating. We're just hanging out. Okay? But then they got documents. They got documents from these meetings. And some of the documents were really incriminating. For example, documents that had language that was verbatim or word for word in laws that had already been passed. Right? Language advised from corporations, advisors, given to politicians who then go back to their constituent base and say, I would like to pass this law as coming from my own, but really being influenced by the politician, or excuse me, by the businesses they had met with at these ALEC campaign, ALEC educational conferences. Okay? So it looks really complicated, but this is how it works. So ALEC gives access to legislators for politicians, for corporate entities. These legislators then pass laws that will then benefit back to the corporations. These corporations then give campaign contributions to these politicians, and it continues that cycle. How many of us are familiar with Arizona's SB 1070? What was that? Yes, sir.
Racial profiling people.
Anyone else familiar with it? What was the language? All right, so in Arizona, they passed a law that said that law enforcement agents could simply come up to somebody and say, could you please show me your papers that to prove that you're legal here? Right? And so, would you please show me that you're legal here? Is that realistic? Why would I suspect him of being illegal? But, more like, would you like to show me your papers? Would you like to show me your papers? Right? So that's why they call it the racial profiling. It was like this idea that who are the illegals in our country that we should be asking them for our papers? And so in the ALEC documents that were discovered by NPR, there were pieces of language that were word for word in the actual law that passed. So sketchy, right? Well, then we find out that not just drug offenses contribute to our incarceration, well, 50%, so does immigration. 10%, almost 11%, out of all of these different offenses. Drugs and immigration. New immigration detention centers being built, right? And deportation hearings, and being held until you get a deportation hearing, right? That's the next big business. That's the next market. And here's the business aspect of it. If you're in business, you know you always got to be thinking about your next market. Because what if, lo and behold, we legalize marijuana? Where will the profits come from? We got to think about our next market. Right? We'll go after the illegals. We'll go after the undocumented folks. And so that is an example of how prison privatization becomes this incentive for not just the prison companies themselves, but all of these entities, all of the corporations that benefit. Because I want to remind us that while we want to complain about those bad private prisons, you know, CCA and GEO, they're actually only a small fraction of the prison system. Most of these prisons, and many of the ones that are being built today and in the most recent years, are not private. They're not made out for money, but we still need money to operate them. So imagine if we took all that money, we decriminalized, we didn't have people for profit. Where would that money go? Where could that money go? Yes, Miracosta. We have more seats here so that people can sit down with some desks in here. Hopefully not desks built by prisoners. So in closing, this is just the exclamation point. This is a racialized issue. Because we know there are immigrants from other countries, all kinds of countries, that come to the United States. But the focus, the rhetoric, the criminalization is on a particular group of people. Black communities and drug criminalization, brown communities and this notion of detention and illegal status, and Asian folks don't even register on the radar, right, of incarceration. But in our own community, in our own backyard in Oceanside, California, our Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander communities are extremely, extremely criminalized. But they don't register on the radar, so it doesn't have a conversation, and the rhetoric is not out there. But it is a reality for our community. Right? In closing, I want to say the aftermath of this. We've been talking about all the people are criminalized and we've got all these people in prison, but the stories of the people who experienced this. And a lot of students look at me and go, oh, Miss Ha, you're Asian and you're smart and you're so sweet and you're so small and you're so cute. Why are you interested in prison so much? Why do you always talk about criminal stuff? And I'm like, well, my dears, it's a personal for me too. I can't tell you how timely some things happen. Like last year I gave a talk on the Vietnam War and it was like right after my grandmother's death, right? She was 103. So as I'm putting together this talk, I get a call from my dad yesterday that my uncle, who'd been in prison for the last 18 years, was released from prison and on parole earlier last year, great family structure, living with my parents. We got him a job in the most Asian thing you can do. Got a nail salon job, right? Got his car. I can't make this up. It's true. Got his job, got a car, he's driving to work. But then he got in trouble. He got an ankle monitor. Ankle monitor for a whole year. So he's almost there. April will be a year, right? But then the parole officer calls and says, they're going to come get you because you violated. And we're like, what did he violate? So the rules are very strict, and they say, if you go anywhere, it was a violent offense. So he was really on monitoring. So if he needs to go to work, parole officer needs to know exactly where he's going to be. So if he needs to get gas, he has to ask for permission. If he needs to stop off to the, you know, place and take a piss, he needs to ask for permission, right? So twice, I guess, along the way, one time he went and got gas without asking permission, and so ding, mark on you. And then the second violation is that he was late coming back. There's a certain number of minutes that they measure from when you leave work, or when you're supposed to leave work, and when you're supposed to get home. And he stayed late at work because when you're in the nail business, sometimes it takes a little longer to do a client who's like, this is uneven. Can you repeat this for me? Okay. Yeah. Actually, I want it round. I don't like it square. Okay, we'll make it round. And so his appointment went a little long, and he was late. And so the news was that he's back in. And so yesterday they took him, and he's going to have a hearing in about 3 months. So he has to sit in a jail cell for the next 3 months to wait for a hearing about why he did what he did. And so that's very personal to me in that story. And when I have students in my class who read these books and we talk about these things, and they come to me and say, Miss Ha, oh my God, this is my life. You've been talking about my life. Right? It makes it real for me, and it makes it real for all of us who should be realizing that these are human stories. These are not just data points and like billions of dollars. These are stories. And so I want to take this